So the interview has begun at this point.
So Northrop had this great program with USC because Northrop was still a fairly young company. They'd just been founded in 39, and this was 61, and they needed to have a higher percentage of advanced degree engineers than they had.
Okay.
So they set up a program with USC, and in fact, the first 15 units for a master's degree were taught at the Northrop campus.
Wow.
The instructors came out after work, and you just stayed after work, and you never even had to lay out a dime.
Yeah.
The company paid it up front, gave you your textbooks, and then the last 15 units, you had to go down to campus.
Okay.
And you had to pay for it up front, and as long as you passed it successfully, the company reimbursed you.
All right.
So Northrop paid for my master's degree.
It's a pretty good deal.
That was a wonderful deal.
1 year program, 2 year? Well, you said 30 units, so.
I think that I took two classes at a time.
Okay.
So it probably took me probably took me 2 years to do it.
Yeah.
I don't remember. I think it was 68 or 69 that I got my master's.
Cool. 68-ish. And of course, obviously an incredibly exciting time in Southern California with the wildly expanding and exciting aerospace industry.
Yeah, the whole area was really growing at the time because people were coming from all over the country to work in aerospace.
Okay, all right. Let's focus up here for a sec. Why did you become a docent here at the museum? When did you become a docent here?
Did I become a docent? Well, that's an interesting question. It's easier to say when I started volunteering at the museum.
Okay, let's start there.
About a year after I retired, I retired from Northrop at the end of 1994.
Okay.
And about a year after I retired, I decided it was time for me to get involved in some other things. And so I went to the Western Museum of Flight. And thinking that maybe I'd get involved in restorations or a few things like that. And before long, somebody said, you know, we need somebody to keep our membership records. And so I became the membership chairman. And a little later, I became the treasurer, and I was on the board. Mm-hmm. And and we weren't doing a lot of tours at the time, so I really wasn't doing what you'd consider docenting. Until we moved down to the Torrance location.
Great. Okay.
And
great.
I was one of the two people that that made the original arrangement for us to move into these hangars.
Okay. So you were integral in that move.
Yeah. Well, that was at the time that Rod was dying.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And so Cindy wasn't. She wasn't available to do things. So another member of the board and I were the two people that came down here and met with Ralph Martin. Found out what it would cost, and we actually polled the board. We're probably getting way off your topic.
But, no, it's interesting. We
polled the board by email to say, do we want to commit to doing this? Because we didn't have a place to go.
We were
being kicked out of Hawthorne, and Northrop was gonna store stuff for us, and they backed out.
Oh, wow.
And at the last minute, we found out about new hangars being built here. And so we pulled the board, and they agreed. And so we signed the deal.
All right. Yeah. So, when did the school tours start happening here?
We actually did a lot of school tours up in Hawthorne.
Okay.
We had a very active program called CLASS, Kids Love Aeronautical Science. We still refer to our program here by that. But that was a much more structured program up at Hawthorne with the Hawthorne School District.
Okay.
And it was actually, there was a curriculum that was set up. And kids would come, and they would spend a good part of a day, like 4 hours.
Okay.
And they would go through all the materials. I was not really involved in that program.
Okay.
But when we moved down here to Torrance, it took some time to start getting relationship with schools again, you know, as we moved down.
Yeah.
And but probably, I don't know, maybe 7-8 years ago, we started having more school tours.
Okay.
And you ask how I became a docent.
Uh-huh.
I have never been a formal docent.
Are you a docent?
I have never been a formal docent. Because I worked on a lot of the things that we have here in the museum, and I know about the other things, for years been called upon to whenever there are school groups, whenever there are groups that need a fair number of people.
Yeah,
I've been called on to do that.
To help shepherd.
And I love doing it.
Okay.
I mean, it's so much fun, especially when you can share some of the behind-the-scenes stories of the things that you worked on. I mean, those of us who worked on F-5s and YF-17s and B-2 bombers and YF-23s, we know some things that you don't necessarily find out in the books.
Not public knowledge.
Not public knowledge.
Well, what behind-the-scenes stories do you share with the kids?
With young kids, it's really hard. Now, when we get to a little bit older children,
yeah,
it's very easy to tell the story of the things like the leading edge extension. Why does a YF-17 have a leading edge extension?
YF-17 leading?
Leading edge extension. We used to use the acronym LEX, L-E-X, all caps.
Uh-huh.
And that story goes back to the formation of, it goes back to the T-38 and the F-5. That's how that story begins.
Okay.
It's kind of a long story.
I think we'll start with the leading as extension. And what does that do?
It allows the airplane to fly to much higher angles of attack than it could without it.
Okay, yeah. And so you were at the center?
Well, I was in wind tunnel test.
Interesting.
I was in wind tunnel test. And I spent my whole career in testing at Northrop from 61 through the end of 94.
Mm-hmm.
And with the T-38 F-5 series of airplanes, the F-5 could fly to a little higher angle of attack than the T-38.
Okay.
And that was, we thought we knew why. We thought it was because the F-5 has a very small leading edge extension. The T-38 does not have a leading edge extension.
Okay.
The F-5 has a leading edge extension because it's actually a way to hide an actuator for the leading edge flap.
Okay.
So that's why it's there.
Okay. I mean,
it's not there for aerodynamics. It's there because the F-5 has a leading edge flap. T-38 doesn't.
Okay.
And you had to have an actuator to actuate it, and it had to be ahead of the leading edge of the wing.
And how important to performance and or outperforming another plane is being able to...
It can be very important. If you are flying along and there's somebody chasing you, and you can pull back the stick, and you can slow your airplane way down by going to a high angle of attack.
Okay,
He can't.
Yeah.
And he cannot. He will shoot past you, and then you can drop your nose back down and go try to shoot him down.
Okay. Yeah.
So it can be
the
it can
difference
be very
between
effective.
Life and death at times. It
can
sounds,
be. Yeah. If you're a fighter pilot, if you're a fighter pilot, the more maneuverability you can have, the better your chances are. And so, we knew that the F-5 could go to a higher angle of attack than the T-38.
We just weren't sure why or how.
We weren't sure why.
Yeah.
But shortly after we sold the F-5 in 1962,
mm-hmm.
Advanced Design started developing the next generation of airplanes.
Okay.
We needed another fighter. I mean, when you have one product, you better be thinking about the next one.
Yeah. Yeah.
So we started developing the next generation, and we said, well, we need to capitalize on this, on this leading edge extension thing, and find out. If we make bigger leading edge extensions, can we go to even higher angles of attack?
Mm-hmm.
And we started doing that in the wind tunnel. I mean, that was in those days, we didn't do things with computational fluid dynamics. It wasn't done on a computer. It was all done in the wind tunnel.
Wow.
And so we started making very simple leading edge extensions on our new airplane. And sure enough, the bigger the leading edge extension, the higher we could go.
Really?
Until we could get to really very high angles of attack.
Okay.
And we still didn't quite know why.
Yeah.
We still didn't quite know why.
Did you guys figure it out?
Yeah. We were testing one rainy day in February. And the air was very moist,
uh-huh.
And we had the airplane. We pitched up to a high angle of attack in the wind tunnel, and all of a sudden we could see vortices peeling off that leading edge extension and coming back over the wing and keeping the flow attached. And so the vortices had been there all along.
You just couldn't see
them.
But
without the moisture, you couldn't see them.
Okay.
And so it was really an aha moment. We now understood the mechanism for making a leading edge extension give you higher angles of attack.
Wow. Yeah.
So
that I can see why that might be lost on a 5 to 7 year old, but the older the kids get, the more.
When you get to high school students,
okay.
or you get to adults.
Right.
Who care about the industry, it's really good.
Yeah.
It doesn't work like with the LAUSD. Well, LAUSD, with those tours, you really talk about the basics. You know, what's left?
Right.
What is left? Why does an airplane go up in the air?
Yeah, I mean,
what is the basic force?
That's the tour I need to take because I'm still learning all that kind of basic stuff myself.
And we do that usually. When I do that over here,
mm-hmm.
With the little wind tunnel that we have, that has a wing in it.
Interesting.
And we tell them that the air, two particles of air coming to the leading edge of the wing. One decides to go over the top, one decides to go into the bottom. And the bottom of an airfoil is flat, pretty flat. The top is a real curve.
Mm-hmm.
But one of the interesting things is those two particles of air have to arrive at the trailing edge at the same time. And because one has to go a longer distance over the top than the one that goes straight along the bottom, it has to go faster.
Yeah, acceleration.
And as it goes faster, it drops the pressure. And as the pressure is low on the top and high on the bottom, it pushes the wing up, and that's what lift is. And so, you know, with a simple showing them a picture of that, and then also turning the wind tunnel on so that they can see as you turn the air on, the wing goes up.
Yeah, yeah.
I tell them, you're now an aeronautical engineer. You now know what makes an airplane fly.
Right. Yeah. So that's an interesting lead into my next question is, what is your favorite thing or exhibit at the museum? Would you say it's the wind tunnel exhibit?
With younger children.
Yeah.
The one that I like to talk about most is around the wind tunnel exhibit and,
okay.
and about lift and what makes an airplane fly.
Excellent. Okay, good. Is there something else? I feel like there's something else you want to talk about.
Well, I think, of course, what the kids love, what the kids absolutely love, is getting to sit in an airplane.
Okay, where can they do that?
Oh, they can do that. With tours like the LAUSD, they get to do it in two places.
Okay.
They get to sit in the only supersonic fighter in the country that I think you can sit in. I don't think there's any other museum that allows you to sit in a supersonic fighter.
Okay.
And then usually we have another airplane that's brought down here, a light airplane, you know, a private airplane. And the kids get to sit in the cockpit,
yeah.
and the pilot tells them all about it.
Yeah.
And the kids absolutely love that.
All right.
And many of the kids, of course, a highlight is space.
Okay. What's the name? What's the name of the supersonic fighter? Excuse me.
The F-5A.
F-5A. Excellent. All right, Fred. Really good stuff. We're moving right along.
It's here. Really interesting when you're talking with kids that are second, third grade. You know, it's very difficult to talk at that level.
Right, but
it, but it's
but you're
so
still
neat.
Making connections somehow.
Oh, it's so neat.
Yeah.
It's so neat.
Yeah.
Especially with the LAUSD kids.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Because you realize that many of these kids, this is all new to them.
Right, sure.
They have not been exposed to it.
Yeah.
You ask these kids, and very few of them have ever flown in an airplane.
Mm-hmm.
And we had a tour today of a Torrance tutoring school.
Mm-hmm.
And these were like second, third graders. I think every one of them had flown in an airplane.
Okay, yeah, so but different levels of privilege between LA.
Very different levels of privilege. And to me, the neat thing is you start to realize that you are exposing these kids to something that they may not have really ever been exposed to before, and making them realize that there may be things that they can do, that people can do, that are different than they ever thought of.
Or in available to them.
But available to them.
But available to them.
Yeah.
I mean, yeah, education is still available to them. And yeah.
Oh, and one of the neat things now is something that I don't have anything to do with, and that's the Women in Aerospace that we did.
Right, right.
And I sat in on a couple of those sessions.
Yeah.
And especially the girls. I think it was an eye-opener to them that, you mean there really are girls that can grow up to be women and fly airplanes like the Harrier?
Yeah, yeah.
And I think some of these kids just never even dreamed that they can do the things that they're now allowed to do.
That's really good stuff. I like that kind of... the nexus of the beginning of that love, and that is the next thing that I wanted to ask you about, is when did your love of aviation begin? Do you remember a specific moment, maybe when you were younger? Or?
No, I don't remember a specific moment, but I grew up on a farm in Iowa.
Right, okay.
Seeing an airplane was kind of a special thing.
Okay.
You didn't see very many. But World War II, I was born before World War II.
Okay.
And so, you know, there would be pictures of World War II airplanes that, I always loved airplanes.
Okay.
Just always loved airplanes. And some of the things I remember the best as a kid growing up was when I was old enough to be driving a tractor out on the farm, cultivating corn, you know, getting the weeds out from the rows of corn with a tractor. And we were only about 100 miles from Offutt Air Force Base in Omaha,
mm-hmm.
where the headquarters of Strategic Air Command, SAC.
Okay.
And often you would see KC-97 refueling planes, refueling B-47 jet bombers over central Iowa.
Okay, and so you would see this.
You'd see them up there. You
all
know?
Right, so you would you'd be able to see two planes link
You'd see the two planes, the two planes hooked up.
And you're just out there weeding the stalks.
I'm out there driving a tractor, and I've always joked that I have probably plowed out more than one row of corn.
Oh yeah.
while watching the airplanes overhead. So I always loved airplanes, and. Went to a very small high school.
Okay, yeah.
There were 24 in my graduating class.
Right, okay.
And I was good at math and science. And mm-hmm. so what little counseling we had in that small high school, they kind of suggested that, you know, engineering might be something I'd be interested in. And I picked aeronautical because I love airplanes.
There you go.
So I'm not sure that that's a very scientific way to...
I think it's a really scientific way
to start a career, but it worked out.
I mean, it's pretty rational. If you could choose one aeronautical device to fly in, plane, jet, glider, you name it, space shuttle, if you could pick one to fly in, what would it be and why?
That's a little bit hard, but...
Well, maybe you could pick two or three. I don't
know. The one I would love to fly in, but I could have never done it,
mm-hmm.
Because they only made a single seat version.
Okay.
Was the YF-17, and that's because I worked on that airplane from its very inception.
I
did much of the wind tunnel testing all the way through that airplane. But they only built two of them, and they were only both single seat versions.
Yeah, what was the intention? What was it intended for?
It was to be the next fighter for the Air Force.
Okay.
It was the competition against the F-16.
Okay.
And the Air Force picked the F-16.
The F-16 was originally single seat, because I know it eventually became a double seat.
Well, it was primarily a single seat, yeah. but they had double seat, two seat versions for training.
Okay.
While we were developing that airplane, we also the government said the Navy needs an airplane, and that's how the F-18 came to be.
Okay.
The F-18 grew out of the YF-17. And
So the F-18, is that the Blue Angels?
The Blue Angels fly the F-18s.
Right.
And it's the main fighter. Of the Navy today.
Still today, of course. So in many ways, when you see the Blue Angels or when you see the Navy's F-18s in some sort of...
Oh, I feel a connection to it.
Yeah, okay. Yeah.
And when I see the B-2 fly over the Rose Parade every year, I feel a connection to that too, because I was involved in that.
Tell me about that. You were the B...
The B-2?
Okay.
Yeah, the B-2 stealth bomber.
What kind of work did you do? So your wind tunnel work?
I was in wind tunnel at the start of that program. By that point in time, I was a manager, so
all right.
I didn't do as much hands-on work.
Okay.
But I was involved in doing the original wind tunnel estimates.
Okay.
For the B-2 program.
All right.
And at that time, that program. It was a very, very black program, very classified program.
Oh, I would imagine so. I mean, I can remember. This was in the early 90s?
It was earlier than that.
Yeah.
It was in the 80s sometime. I don't remember exactly when. Because the airplane flew significant amount of time before I retired.
Okay. All right.
When I was first involved... I was told to go over to some nondescript building that was not on the Northrop premises, and I was told to go over there to meet with the people about a program.
Mm-hmm.
And the building didn't say Northrop on it or anything.
Yeah.
And that was the start of the B-2 program. There were maybe 30 or 40 people working.
Yeah. So remind me again, the B-2, it was. Undetectable at the time by radar,
The idea was that it would have such a small radar cross section,
okay,
that radars would not be able to really pick it up.
Right. Yeah. And of course, what made the B-2 was it had a unique body design. Is that correct?
It had the unique shape.
Yeah.
Of course, it's a flying wing.
There you go.
And,
okay.
And so it inherently has a lower profile.
Yeah.
But then the specific shapes, the specific angles of the back edge, which
sure.
kind of looks like a sawtooth in a way,
yeah.
Those are all designed for to confuse radar.
Okay, so it's all part of the stealth.
Yeah. And the materials that it was made out of were also very special. And there's everything is very smooth.
And so you were kind of at the center of maybe not so much design, but...
My group, which I was in charge of at the time, was involved in doing all the wind tunnel testing.
Okay, yeah.
Now, we also built the models that were used for radar cross-section testing. We had a model shop as part of our wind tunnel operation, and they built the pole, what they call pole models. You would make a model, and they would put it up on a pole, and they would shoot radar at
really?
It. To
how high would the pole go?
They were pretty tall.
Okay.
I was never out on a range, but some of these were, they had full-scale pole models of these airplanes.
Wow.
And so they were big
models. I can imagine, yeah. Yeah, that's why I was asking. I was wondering,
A lot of the models were smaller.
Uh-huh.
All right. And the government had these ranges that were out someplace way out in some desert,
yeah,
in very secret locations,
uh-huh.
and they could only test when satellites were not flying over and all of this kind of stuff.
Ari, but, go ahead.
But the interesting, well, I don't know if it was interesting or not, but the B-2 program, being a black program, was a much more difficult program to work on,
mm-hmm.
because you couldn't tell anybody what you were doing. If you went away on a trip, you couldn't say that you worked for Northrop.
Mm-hmm.
I went on trips where I couldn't tell my wife where I was going.
Wow.
But she knew where at Northrop. She had a number to call if she needed to get in touch with me.
Wow.
So that's exciting. My wife was never happy about that.
Right. Are you, do you even work for Northrop? I didn't know that. I knew a little bit of your background, but I wasn't aware of that. So, if your dream came true, you'd be flying the YF-17. Are you a licensed pilot?
I am not.
Yeah. Okay.
Never was a pilot.
Never a pilot.
That never rose to the high enough priority.
Well, you're too busy designing and testing and working.
Well, and raising a family and doing lots of other things.
Of course.
And flying is not an inexpensive hobby.
Of course not. Nope.
So there were other things that were much more important.
And
I also have a problem. In the early days, it would have been tough for me because I'm colorblind.
Of course, yeah.
And I didn't realize
that, yeah.
And so being colorblind...
that could be a problem. Is that saying...
I don't think it is as much of a problem now as it was then.
Right, yeah. Do you have a favorite story or experience involving aviation, whether it was from your time in doing wind tunnel testing, or maybe just something that happened on a commercial flight, or can you think of anything that was aviation related? If you can't think of anything on the fly,
I'll tell you about my favorite airplane flight ever.
All right, let's hear it.
I was probably 10 years old. My best friend, my best friend's dad, was a partner in owning a single-engine Luscombe, which was a single-engine airplane about the size of a Piper Cub. And I got a ride with him and his dad in his Luscombe, taking off on snow skis.
Attached to the bottom, just
skis mounted to the wheels of the airplane on his dad's farm. And that was my best airplane flight ever.
Yeah, can't beat that one.
Can't beat that one.
All right, you guys just.
That was another one of those things that probably hooked me on airplanes.
Cool, you guys just did some low altitude stunts there above the cornfields.
We didn't do any stunts. I think we just flew around.
Yeah.
But it was so neat.
Yeah.
So neat.
All right, that's gonna do it. I really thank you for your time. Just one other thing. Is there anything other that you feel like we didn't cover though? Maybe about the specifics of. What you enjoy about being a docent or about the tours, anything we didn't touch on that you want?
To me, it's just so great, you know, having spent my whole career in aerospace, it's so neat being able to still stay associated with aerospace.
Okay.
And it's especially neat to try to pass on some of that love for aviation and airplanes and things to a younger generation, and to hopefully encourage some kids to become engineers or pilots or scientists or whatever they want to be, but to let them know about the opportunities and that they have dreams, and they need to follow up on those dreams.
All right. Well.
So you just kind of hope in all this. That once in a while you make a little difference in somebody's life.
Yeah, I hear you. And I know.